Latin America is not neglected at Warwick. We have been teaching Latin American history and literature since the mid-1970s. I won't tell you when I arrived, but you might suspect that I was around quite early. We set up a degree which at that time, and has remained until quite recently, unique in that we looked at the whole of the Americas. So we looked at North America, the United States, Canada, the Caribbean, and Latin America, both Spanish America and Portuguese America. Over time, but we also looked at the literatures. We also teach the students Spanish. So it's a degree which has stood the test of time. We've expanded slightly. It's now, interestingly, a model which is being adopted by colleges up and down the United States as they see increasingly the Americas not simply as something peculiar to themselves. They're even admitting that other countries are part of the Americas and can even borrow the name from them from time to time. So you will find comparative American studies programs, particularly at a postgraduate level, throughout the continent, throughout the United States, certainly. The teaching by specialists of Latin American history and literature beyond Latin America is a consequence of political developments, a consequence of the creation of area studies programs in the post-Second World War period. You have still increasingly global history is rather crowding us out, but you have Asian studies centers, African studies centers, Latin American studies centers. Africa and Asian studies centers were formed accompanying and following decolonization, following the Second World War. Latin American studies institutes and centers and programs were formed after the Cuban Revolution. They started in the United States, and they were put in place very much to understand the continent and to make sure that no more Cuban revolutions would occur. It was part of, in a sense, Kennedy's Alliance for Progress, which the aim of that was to reform Latin America so as to prevent future revolutions, to prevent the Cuban Revolution from crossing over onto the Spanish main and infecting the body politic of Spanish America, of course, as you know, its backyard. So I owe my position very much to that American power politics. That's why in Britain we set up 7 or 8 centers for Latin American studies, Glasgow, Liverpool, Manchester. Warwick's never had a center, but we've had this degree, Oxford, Cambridge, London. Interestingly, in spite of the fact that from time to time Latin America falls off the map in terms of world news interest, these centers have all survived. It's remained a very dynamic subject. And we've created new generations of scholars. So we owe our existence to the, as specialists in this area, to the desire on the part of the United States and its ally in Europe, Great Britain, to stop revolutions. But of course, once we're lodged into universities, we can say and preach what we like. In the end, of course, it was U.S. military schools, not centers for Latin American studies, which were necessary to prevent the Cuban Revolution spreading to the mainland. And it was soldiers and generals, officers trained in these American military schools, which then applied the so-called dirty wars in the 1960s through until the 80s, which prevented Marxist or just nationalist very often revolutionary movements from taking root, or removed them if they did. In the case of Chile, for instance, in 1973, Nicaragua in 1989. So that's how things panned out by the 1980s. The very interesting work recently on how the lessons that the United States learnt, particularly in Central America, in stopping the spread of revolution, were then turned to the Middle East. You see very similar ways of dealing with Islamic radicalism, and very much the plan of shock and awe that we saw happening in Iraq was pioneered initially in Central America during the 1970s and 80s. So the subject has survived. And I'd just like to give you a few historical reasons why we in Europe, there are a lot of non-European people present in this room, but I'm talking about, in a sense, the teaching staff here and people in my profession why we can continue being quite sure that every year we will recruit very large number of students to our courses. The New World obviously has always been intrinsically popular and fascinating region for Europeans since the discovery in 1492. Central America and South America especially has always been perceived as a land of fables and utopias. So there has always been a fascination in Europe as part of the European mind, really, since the discovery, since the beginning of the expansion of Europe. This was Europe's first overseas imperialism, and the Spanish and Portuguese variants of it were global at that time. They spread to Asia as well as to America. But they were different from later European imperialisms, which on the whole came in the 17th century, but most of them in the 19th century, by the way that the Spanish and the Portuguese colonized. They mixed with the native population, they reshaped it, they Hispanized it, they civilized it. They also mixed with the large numbers of Africans they brought over to do the hard labor, the African population. So you get a unique imperialism which involved Europeans settling and mixing and creating really a new hybrid society. This, again, fascinates us because it's so different from what the problems we're dealing with in Europe today in becoming multiracial societies, and it's very different, obviously, from the colonial experience in Asia, of Europeans in Asia and Africa. Another reason why I think Latin America is intriguing and difficult, in a sense, to get our minds around is that the end of the empires came very early in the 1820s. So you have some of the first independent post-colonial republics being formed in Latin America in the 1820s. This was not accompanied by the decolonization of these areas in social terms. The Spanish and the Portuguese remained. A few merchants and administrators were kicked out. A few bishops had to go back home. But even they came back, and it continued to be an area of Hispanic colonization, migration over the 19th century before other largely Mediterranean Europeans began to occupy the area. So the empire as a direct sovereign colony ended, but the colonial structures remained. And furthermore, they became more complex and more rigid over the 19th century as a result of British informal imperialism. Britain sort of stepped into the shoes left by the Portuguese and by the Spanish, and I didn't need to colonize directly, although quite large numbers of the British did move into places like Argentina and Chile. The British built the railways throughout Spanish America. So it was an informal imperialism which built upon the existing social inequalities and power imbalances established by Spain and Portugal. Then, of course, you've got the 20th century. I don't really have to tell you about the 20th century. The Americans stepped into the British shoes after the First World War, and you have America's century of regarding Spanish America and Portuguese America, Latin America, as it became known in the late 19th century, very much as its backyard. And if it wasn't intervening directly and acquiring footholds, it was forever meddling and still does meddle politically and economically. Now, the consequence of this layering over time of external colonial influences leads to a simple fact which students, when they start studying Latin America, become very apparent of, familiar with quite soon, which is that seemingly a continent of revolutions. When you think of Latin America, you think certainly in the 20th century of revolutions, of revolutionary violence, of charismatic leaders such as Fidel Castro. In practice, it is a continent of extraordinary social stability over five centuries in terms of the elites, one colonial elite handing over to another. But the shape of society has remained very intractable to major social change. And events such as the kind we witnessed in the last few days in Tunisia and Egypt are so similar to those that we witnessed following the collapse of the Soviet Union the late 1980s, have not yet been experienced in Latin America. None of Latin America's 20th century revolutions, the Mexican Revolution of 1910, Peron in Argentina in the 1940s, the Bolivian Revolution of 1952, the Nicaraguan Revolution of 1979, the Cuban Revolution of 1959, involved such massive popular mobilization, spontaneous, peaceful, as we are witnessing today in Egypt. That may surprise you, and many of you may disagree, and Mike may disagree, but it's a different kind of mobilization that we witnessed in Latin America's 20th century revolution that we are still witnessing today in this turn to the left in Latin America. On the whole, Latin American revolutions have been led by small guerrilla vanguards. That was true in Cuba and Nicaragua, or by the military. The Mexican Revolution fundamentally was a revolution of armies. What put the new revolutionary regime in place was an army, and it remained the backbone, really, of the Mexican Revolution throughout the 20s and 30s. The Peruvian Revolution was entirely top-down, 1968. That broke the Ancien Regime. That broke the great estates of the highlands of Peru. All revolutions have been created by disciplined union and party bureaucracies under charismatic leaders. That was the case in Bolivia in 1952. It was a tin miners' union with some help from peasants. But organized people, top-down, well-controlled, well-disciplined. Chile, as you know, under Allende, an inspiring and charismatic leader, that came out of a very well-organized party that had allied with other parties that put together a Marxist project. It was organized. It involved, of course, mobilization of your supporters, but it was not the entire Chilean society that got out in the streets. The changes of power, revolutionary situations and moments have been quite brief. You haven't had this period of the absence of sovereignty in the history of Latin America. So with the exception of Cuba, the end result of Latin America's attempts at revolution have all been reform rather than revolution, but as often also reaction, long periods of military dictatorship punishing the left for having tried to reshape society. Now, I'll go back to a recent, a very influential global history written by a Cambridge historian who's a specialist in India called Chris Bailey. It's called The Birth of the Modern World, 1780 to 1914. He calls it a world history. This is a so-called global history. But the Spanish world, the Portuguese world, are completely absent, whether it's Europe or whether it's this vast area of Central and South America. He excludes it, I think partly because he's got enough to do to look at other parts of the world, but also because he doesn't consider Latin America really as modern. Fundamentally, he sees Latin America even today as intrinsically unmodern, and particularly during this period, the book covers 1780 to 1914, so essentially the 19th century. In spite of Latin America's liberal and republican revolutions, which brought the new fledgling republics into being, this was not really political modernity. These were small elites inheriting colonies. And only during the 1990s, and he reflects on this, does Chris Bailey observe and detect anything resembling the modern nation building that he traces in Asia, in places like India, Indonesia, and parts of Africa. The beginnings of a sense of difference, of the need to take on colonial governments and to overthrow those governments, the beginnings of nationalism. He doesn't see any sign of that in Latin America until the 1990s, and what he notes as similar are the indigenous movements that are evident in Spanish America, Latin America, after the fifth centenary, when states were wondering how to celebrate Columbus's landing and their debt to Spain. much of the population said, sorry, we're not going to celebrate this. This is something that this was bad news for us, and we want a different kind of commemoration of this invasion. And this was the beginning in Latin America of a much more pluralistic sense of nationhood. So that was what I think attracted Bailey. And he said that to be modern, you really have to include everybody. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking now. I wasn't on your lineup this evening. I've been brought in to stand in for another. But I'll leave you just with a question. How then, given this view of, in a sense, an unsuccessful revolutionary continent so far, how then are we to view Latin America's turn to the left over the past 10 years, the so-called Pink Revolution? Is it a continuation of top-down, corporative, authoritarian revolutionary experiments of the past involving rather limited popular mobilization? Or are we witnessing something quite different? Now, that's something I'm very interested in. I try and find stuff in the newspapers, but we have experts here who might be able to tell you more about that.
Well, good evening. I'm delighted to be here. The sense is that Latin America has been neglected and it's very hard to hear much about in this country, then the Caribbean has almost effectively fallen off the media's map and government's map and to some extent even NGOs' map as well. Let me tell you a little bit about myself, and then I'll go on to say a little bit about why I believe the Caribbean is going to come back onto everybody's maps in a way which perhaps was hard to imagine even 4 or 5 years ago. I'm the director of the Caribbean Council. I've spent nearly the whole of my working career, 35 years, working with the Caribbean, initially as a journalist and broadcaster for the UK media and the Caribbean media as well. Then I became director of the Caribbean Council about 10 years ago. And the Caribbean Council works with Caribbean industries, Caribbean governments at the interface between politics and economics, trying to bring about solutions for industries and governments that actually make them visible, that make their voice heard. So what I do is extremely practical. It's a little bit academic, but it actually looks at taking real issues and finding real practical solutions. I think the issue for me in talking to you today is to try to get you to focus a little bit on a part of the world that for most people is either forgotten entirely or utterly marginal. Part of the reason for that is because you have this extraordinary diversity of countries and islands. They range from Suriname and Guyana on the South American mainland, speaking Dutch and English, up through a chain of English-speaking, Spanish-speaking, French-speaking, and Dutch-speaking islands, some very large like Cuba, the island of Hispaniola with Dominican Republic and Haiti, and then larger English-speaking Caribbean islands like Jamaica, right through to the tiniest overseas territories, British overseas territories, for instance, like Anguilla, with a population of just 15,000 people. The point is that about the Caribbean is that it's very easy for us to talk about the Caribbean. The reality is you've got lots and lots of completely different countries, different cultures, different backgrounds, different histories. What I want to do is talk a little bit about where the Caribbean's place is in the world today. And I would like to start by referring to some remarks I heard the late Michael Manley, a former Prime Minister of Jamaica and a great speaker, deliver at the end of the Cold War. The Berlin Wall had fallen, and it was a truly determining and defining moment, particularly for countries in the Third World. And his remarks matched the occasion. Speaking as only he could, he spelt out the implications for the Caribbean and for the poorer nations in a world in which the United States had become the only global power. He saw then that the region was likely to become of less interest to the outside world. And his remarks, although measured and thought-provoking, were perhaps many years ahead of their time in recognizing that the US-led consensus would emerge that would seek to remake all, certainly in the Caribbean and other parts of the world, in its own image. And so, as he predicted, by the early 1990s, the Caribbean had largely become strategically irrelevant and less able to appeal for support on the basis that its relative underdevelopment or smallness made it vulnerable. So much so that by the latter part of the decade, it was easy for Europe to unravel the economic preferences that it put in place during the Cold War for products such as sugar, bananas, and rum. And in its place, substitute a largely unfocused and poorly coordinated policy that sought to encourage regionalism and competition based on US economic liberalism. As a consequence, and this is something, a problem that I've been working with in trying to get the Caribbean's issues recognized over the last decade, as a consequence, much of the Caribbean entered this century with only narcotics trafficking, terrorism-related activity, criminality, and the presence of some strategic hubs of interest to help keep the region on the United States and European Union's world map. Even then, I have come across, talking to ministers and senior officials here and in Washington, an attitude that suggests that at those higher policy levels, these largely security-driven concerns could be contained through vigilance and cooperation. However, what I want to say to you tonight is that all of this could be changing, and that the Caribbean may, for completely different reasons, be coming to be seen once again as of some strategic importance. Recently, what we've seen is multiple and overlapping interests in the region emerge as states, including China, Brazil, Venezuela, Iran, and India, seek to gain influence and a role in the Americas, obviously in Latin America, but hardly understood at the present time in the Caribbean as well. What some of these nations now envisage are relationships that pass beyond the sort of unremarkable decisions to invest in tourism or provide technical assistance in countries like Antigua or Jamaica, or to give support to capital projects such as road building, to move on to take a more strategic interest. And let me give you a few examples which you probably won't read about in any newspaper in this country, and you would be hard-pressed to read about it in any newspaper, even in the Caribbean. For example, the China National Petroleum Corporation has purchased one of the largest oil storage facilities in the Caribbean, in the island of St. Eustatius. Now, St. Eustatius is a Dutch-related overseas territory. You may wonder what the Chinese are doing. China's interest at the present time is in a whole range of other strategic purchases. They are looking to buy ports, they're looking to buy railways, they're looking to build roads, and they're offering support and training for the region's military. And the Caribbean, on the whole, is a region that is predominantly not militarized. At the same time, Iran, again, a very surprising player to find in the Caribbean, is undertaking minerals mapping exercises in at least two Caribbean countries where it is looking predominantly for rare earth. These are very special minerals that there's only a limited quantity of in the world, and they're key to high-tech production. And then, of course, there is another relationship, a long-standing relationship with Caracas, where President Chavez has developed what's called Petrocaribe arrangement to the extent now that virtually every Caribbean country is dependent on the oil that Venezuela provides at heavily discounted rates with associated development programs. And then again, Brazil is interested in the Caribbean in very deep water exploration. And at a much lesser level, but just starting to appear, India is looking at softer levels of investment and an education-led approach. I'm not arguing necessarily there's anything wrong with what is happening, but to suggest that the scenarios associated with, or to suggest that the scenarios with the Cold War are going to be repeated. But rather, it's to note that if the Caribbean again comes to be seen as having strategic significance, the outcome and future outcomes in the region may be less than predictable and may refocus the broader external attention from the United States, from Europe, that has all but disappeared. And I think it's important to understand that this is happening as most Caribbean nations are diversifying their relationships. So you have a new range of external players that are non-traditional to the region, and you have the Caribbean countries themselves beginning to look at their interrelationships in a very different way. So Suriname and Guyana, for reasons associated with economic development and their own security, are looking at deepening their relations with Brazil and other countries in Latin America. Belize, on the Central American mainland, is becoming ever more closely integrated into an economic partnership with its Central American neighbors. And the nations of the Western Caribbean are beginning to explore whether there may be serious longer-term value in deepening relations between themselves. And Trinidad, an oil and gas-rich country, sees its future completely differently. It sees itself as the center of a series of concentric circles, which include Latin America, the Caribbean, and the United States, to which it is the largest liquefied natural gas supplier. And then there are other interesting processes taking place. The small islands of the Eastern Caribbean are entering into an economic union, which may bring Barbados into that closer integration as well. And you then have a paradox. The Dominican Republic, which has expanded its relations across Latin America, it has trade agreements with Central America, would dearly love to have a much stronger relationship with the English-speaking Caribbean. But despite that, it's thwarted at almost every turn by cultural differences. And then you have Cuba. Cuba is a case apart and a case within the region. It's, at the present time, seeking to turn its hugely inefficient economic system into something more dynamic that partially involves deeper integration with Venezuela and others in Latin America. And then, of course, you have Haiti, which certainly, from my perspective, and that, I think, of many Haitian people, seems to be becoming a nation that's being recolonized, dependent on the international community and NGOs in a way that it never was previously. All of which is to say nothing about the tensions that exist between the tiniest countries in the Caribbean, the British, Dutch, overseas territories, and the metropoles, and indeed the French Department d'Outre-mer. I think what is important to understand when you come to look at the Caribbean is that with all these overlapping influences superimposed on a region that culturally sees itself as singular, is likely to create new stresses and new strains. I think what you will begin to see is Caribbean governments trying to find ways in which they can relate to outside partners because they are, on the whole, economically dependent on IMF and other multilateral programs, while trying to relate to each other in a way which becomes increasingly incoherent. I'm going to stop there because I know Michael wants to talk specifically about Latin America, but I just want to leave you with the thought that the Caribbean is usually neglected. It's usually looked past to the larger countries of Latin America. But I suspect that in the next decade, as most of you go out to work, and if some of you work with Latin America and the Caribbean, you will see the Caribbean become an important strategic prize for a number of countries. Thank you.
Good evening. Bring your greetings from Haiti today, which looks like a country under occupation. The tanks of the UNUSA, the United Nations mission in Haiti, are all over. This morning, the Electoral Council announced the results 2 months late of the so-called elections of November 28. The country is quiet, because they feel that they are on the watch, and perhaps guns may be drawn on them. It's as if to say you are having democracy under the cannons. I'm speaking from Haiti. Haiti nicknamed the poorest country of the Western Hemisphere. But it was not always that poor and feeble. In fact, historically, the so-called poorest nation in the Americas was the wealthiest colony of France in the 17th and 18th centuries. Commerce flourished between Europe and Haiti, which provided sugar, coffee, cocoa, indigo, precious wood, and much more to many parts of Europe. Haiti was such a plum that Spain, France, and England, yes, England too, fought over it, while the British left for other Caribbean isles, the French and Spaniards stayed and finally divided the wealthy domain among themselves in 1625. Yes, forgive me this bit of history, but I think it is important to understand the situation of Haiti today. There were three major revolutions in the late 1700s. That of the United States of America in 1776, that of France in 1789, and that of Haiti beginning in 1791. But Haiti's the least talked about revolution was the more disturbing. Imagine black slaves challenging the mode of production based on slave labor. What a country to threaten the economic order of the times. Haiti had to be severely punished. Thus, was it bottled up with a merciless embargo that lasted about 60 years and saddled with a debt that is equivalent to nearly $25 billion in today's currency. That's how Haiti's independence was welcomed by the powerful of the times. Forget that our defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte's troops in 1803 was the emperor's first major humiliation. It paved the way to Waterloo and Saint-Louis. Forget that we forced Napoleon to sell the Louisiana Territory to the Americans for $15 million. That permitted the new American nation to double its territory. And in the process, we spoiled Napoleon's dream of Empire America. Forget that we became the beacon of freedom for the whole hemisphere and helped Simon Bolivar liberate Gran Colombia, including Colombia and Panama, Venezuela and Ecuador. And the movement of liberation spread throughout Latin America. Arguably then, Haiti must be considered the cornerstone of freedom and wealth of the Americas. Yet, it had to be punished, and he has not gained the reward of its work. I will not absolve our own leadership that has failed the country over two centuries of independence. Somehow, our leaders fought and forgot the motto by which we gain our independence. L'union fait la force. L'union fait la force. In unity, there is strength. I suggest that we must go back to that unity to stand up against the forces that would keep Haiti down, as an example of what happens when you dare to defeat the slave masters on the battlefield. As if to say, you are better off as a slave or being dependent on better folks. I have been denouncing the forces of oppression in my country since I was in my 20s. Now, in my decade 70s, I am more determined to see Haiti regain its glory of yesteryears. On January 12, 2010, when the horrible earthquake threatened one-fifth of the country's landmass, including the capital of Port-au-Prince, I became more convinced of the need to decentralize, yes, decentralize the development of Haiti. When you consider that the economic damage amounted to 80%, although only one-fifth of the country was destroyed, yet you have to admit that we have put almost all our eggs in one basket. I was also struck on January 12, 2010, by the nonchalance of our leadership. None of our leaders came forth with a word of comfort for our people in distress. I had to represent my country, and defend it, although I was about 3,000 miles from home, away in Washington, D.C. However, by 10 p.m. on the 12th of January 2010, I found out that all our senior officials were alive. Yes, we had lost quite a few of the cadre. But the leadership, the senior officials were all alive. And Radio Signal FM, one radio station in Pétionville, a suburb of Port-au-Prince, was still on the air, but no one came forward to give the people some comfort. It was at that point that I said to myself, new leadership is needed in this country. And with the help of the willing, we intend to challenge the status quo. We intend to reawaken in our youth the spirit of unity to accomplish great things in a modern Haiti. A Haiti decentralized, a Haiti reforested, a Haiti dependent on green energy. And we do have sun, the sun abundantly. I was struck also on February 12th, 1 month after the earthquake, when I visited my country. And I saw that all the traffic lights in Port-au-Prince were still operating in the desert. And then I looked, and all of them were powered by sun energy, by the energy of sun. And at that time, I said, Haiti shall go solar. We have to do that. We can do it, especially with the solidarity of the whole world toward Haiti, manifested last year when we were hit with a major catastrophe. Sure, we've been through a lot in the past 12 months. Earthquake, hurricane, cholera, and now political gridlock resulting from the fraudulent elections of last November 28. solution offered by the international community, especially the Organization of American States, I don't believe would bring any long-lasting solution. We are now at a dangerous turn, at the crossroads, as February 7th approaches. That's only 4 days away. Constitutionally, the mandate of the president ends on that date, but it threatens to stay on until May 14th. As if he would accomplish something good for the country in 3 months, after failing in nearly 5 years to organize free, fair, and democratic elections. Those who have got a legitimate government benefit from the $11 billion pledged by the international community to build Haiti back better. In the name of the Haitian people, I thank you for listening. I thank you for your help so far since January 12, 2010. And I challenge you to remain engaged as we undertake the long journey toward Haiti's renewal and revival. Thank you for listening, and I'm sorry I could not be with you tonight. Good night.
Thank you very much, Guy, and thank you very much in particular to those of you who've organized this splendid initiative of One World Week. I want to congratulate you for the resolutely internationalist spirit of this event at a time when I think that, sadly, one feels in this country a certain turning away in some ways from engagement with the world, which I think would be disastrous. I also want to thank you for the title of the session, because you allow me to talk about my book, which came out at the end of 2007. So what I'm going to do is summarize a little bit some of the arguments in the book and give you a sort of preview of what would be the second edition, I hope, because some things have happened in the last 3 years. I called the book Forgotten Continent. In fact, you're more accurate geographically when you say Forgotten Land, although it probably should be plural, because, of course, Latin America is not actually a continent, as the geographers amongst you know. But, and nor, as Latin Americans always remind me, have they forgotten it. What I meant by forgotten was that if you're sitting in Europe or in the eastern seaboard of the United States or the middle of the United States, not perhaps the south and the west, when you look at the world, if you're a business person, you tend to look at China and India and their astonishing growth rates. You might look at Africa as a source of intolerable suffering and conflict that pricks your conscience. You might look at the Islamic world as, in some ways, or parts of it, as in some ways a strategic threat. And where is Latin America in that? Well, it's simply at the bottom of a long list of people's priorities, so it's overlooked. Now, you know, neglect is largely benign. And, you know, I'm not arguing that one should hyperventilate about what one should do for Latin America. Clearly, there are some countries in the region that need outside help, and Haiti being one of them, tragically so. But most of my remarks refer to the larger countries in mainland Latin America. And I argue that they're actually doing really quite well through their own efforts. And at the end of the day, countries develop basically from their own efforts. Now, this neglect is mirrored within Latin America by what Albert Hirschman, a distinguished, now rather elderly economist, called fracasomania, the obsession with failure, an abiding sense of failure within Latin America, within Latin American intellectual elites, which is really a reflection on its relative failure of democracy and economic development compared with the countries of North America, the United States and Canada, with which Latin American countries share their landmass. And there's a huge and long debate within Latin America about the causes of that relative failure. The left blames outsiders, blames the United States. You heard a very eloquent exposition of that view from Guy. I happen to disagree with it in part, because if you look at the, I mean, I think the United States is guilty as charged in Guatemala in 1954, where it overthrew a progressive democratic government, and that was unconscionable. But its direct interventions in Latin America are really confined to the Caribbean basin and Central America, which doesn't excuse them, but it does mean that as a factor, they do not really have much explanatory power in the rest of the region. Where, yes, it's true, the United States supported dictatorships, and you know, that was a mistake, but its support was rarely the decisive factor in these countries. And one has to remember, too, that the Cold War in Latin America was fought by two sides. The Soviet Union and Cuba were trying to impose an authoritarian project of the left. At the same time, the United States was supporting authoritarian projects from the right. The right in Latin America blames the region's relative failure to develop democracy and prosperous economic development on the legacy of Iberian Catholic corporatism, which they held to be inimical to individual initiative and therefore to capitalism and to democracy. I actually think both those arguments are wrong. I mean, I think it's a much more complex story involving geography, history, patterns of settlement, institutions, and extreme inequality, which I do think has played an important and negative role in the region. But that search for that sense of failure had political consequences, and it has led to, in Latin America, to a particular kind of recurrent search for saviors, if you like, for populist saviors who will address who often trade in scapegoats. Right? Now, over the last 2 or 3 decades. I think a lot has changed in the region. I mean, I first went to live in Latin America in 1982, and I lived for a total of 15 years at various times in Peru, Mexico, and Brazil. And Latin America today is simply not the same place as it was in 1982. You've had, I would argue, a lot more progress than is commonly recognized. And it's been a result of a series of factors. Firstly, democracy. Everywhere in Latin America is now democratic, apart from Cuba. Now, of course, there are imperfections and limitations in the democracies, but they're democracies, imperfect though they are. And that has made a huge difference. Secondly, urbanization. Latin America is now, depending on how you do the numbers, 2/3, 3/4 urbanized. Cities breed citizens. It's much easier to get services, basic services, to people living in cities than to people living halfway up an Andean mountainside, right? Thirdly, economic reform. It's taken a while, but the economic reforms that happened in the 80s and 90s have produced stable economies and faster growth. But crucially, they slayed inflation. Inflation is a tax on the poor, and it also inhibits both companies and households from thinking beyond tomorrow. right? You cannot do any kind of economic long-term planning when you have no idea what things will cost, right? It wiped out credit in the region as well. So the conquest of inflation has had huge positive implications. Lastly, democracy has brought much better social policy and a big increase in social spending across the region. Now, what's the evidence for these assertions that I'm making? If you look at the period between 2003 to 2008, you had average annual growth of 5.5% in the region. Population growth in Latin America is now 1.5% a year. So in other words, you had per capita, an increase in per capita income of 4% a year for five years. In that period, 40 million people in Latin America left poverty on the strictest definitions of poverty. I mean, on some other definitions, you'd get a larger number there. And crucially, inequality declined in the early 2000s. There's a study by two economists, which I recommend if you read if you're interested, Nora Lustig and Lopez Calva, who find that in 14 out of 17 countries where you have comparable numbers, inequality declined. Now, Latin America remains the region of the world with the most extreme income distribution. So much more is needed, extreme inequality of income distribution. But at least the trend has started moving in the right direction. Now, of course, the commodity boom helped in that. Many Latin American countries are exporters of commodities. But so too did better economic policies. And the proof of that really came with the Great Recession. Latin America couldn't avoid the recession, but it was brief and shallow in most places, not everywhere. And we've seen a strong recovery last year. The region as a whole, there was economic growth of 6%, and this year it'll be 4 to 5% in all probability. And interestingly, importantly, the impact of the recession on poverty was much less than many economists feared, and much less than in past recessions in Latin America. And in fact, the calculations or the estimates by the UN Economic Commission on Latin America and the World Bank and a university in Argentina, the Universidad de La Plata, who are the number crunchers on this, they agree that that poverty now is a bit less than it was before the recession. Why is that? Because the social safety net is much better than it used to be. 110 million people in Latin America benefit from what are called conditional cash transfers, CCTs, like Bolsa Familia in Brazil and Oportunidades in Mexico. And these are a Latin American invention. They're targeted at the poorest families, and the payment goes to mothers, to women, and they're contingent. The condition is that they have to take their children for regular health checks and make sure that they stay in school. The idea being that you ameliorate poverty in this generation and try and prevent its transfer to the next generation. And these programs have had, they're not a panacea, but they've had a significant effect in reducing poverty and inequality. But there were other reasons for the region's relatively strong performance. The first was that those better economic policies allowed Latin American governments for the first time to do what European governments have long done, which is when you have a recession, you have counter-cyclical policies. I mean, the economists amongst you will know those as automatic stabilizers in that, you know, social spending goes up, spending on the unemployment benefit goes up during a recession. Well, you can only do that if the government can afford to do that. And equally, you know, central banks normally cut interest rates during recessions. Well, again, you can only do that if you're not worried about a run on your currency. Well, for the first time, you know, most Latin American countries were able to increase spending during a recession because they'd run much more responsible fiscal policies than in the past. And because of the credibility that their central banks had built up in terms of combating inflation, they were able to cut interest rates without prompting a run on the currency. Right? So that helped to mitigate the recession. Another big factor was that banking systems in Latin America are much more solid than they turned out to be in here. And that's as a result of the kind of painful lessons learned through experience, through bitter experience, with banking crises in many countries in the 1980s and 1990s. Banks are much more tightly regulated, and their capital base is much higher. I mean, the average capital base of Brazilian banks is 16%. The target under Basel III, the international agreement on these, is 8%. Basel II, sorry, it's going to go up under Basel III. So the result of that was that the financial system did not magnify the impact of the recession. It didn't act as a trigger to make the recession worse. The other important factor is China, and David's mentioned China. China has become a very important trade partner. It's now Brazil's largest single export market. The same goes for Peru and Chile, and one or two other countries. And China, of course, carried on growing. And China's demand for commodities has kept their prices high. Now, the picture is not the same everywhere. Ronald Reagan, when he visited Latin America for the first time in 1982, when he came back to the US, this was after he had told an audience in Sao Paulo how delighted he was to be in Bolivia, he came back and said, "You'd be surprised, you know, they're all different countries down there." And he was absolutely right. And one should never forget that. They are all different countries. They may speak the same language, except for the most important one, the biggest one, which is Brazil, and some of the Caribbean countries. But they are all different countries. And you know, there have been different developments in different countries. I mean, Venezuela has not fared nearly as well through the recession. Venezuela has remained in recession for 2 years, despite the fact that the oil prices remain very, very high. Mexico had a much steeper, deeper recession because of its integration with the US. It's now recovering strongly, again, because of its integration with the US. But Central America and the Caribbean were quite badly affected and are taking longer to recover. And I think that there are reasons to worry about Central America and the Caribbean for also because of, you know, drug trafficking and violence and so on. So what now? Some people are starting to talk about a Latin American decade. It's a sort of marketing slogan. It's quite a nice marketing slogan. No? I mean, the question is, can it happen? I mean, people have started to notice Brazil. You increasingly hear everybody from, you know, politicians to, you know, BBC news journalists who have 30 seconds to talk about a global issue. They say China and Brazil, or China, India, and Brazil. So it's appeared on, you know, a mental map. But it's actually more than Brazil. Brazil is terribly important just because of its size, and because in many ways what's been happening in Brazil has been a very interesting process of faster economic growth and a more inclusionary democracy. No? But, you know, some of the same things are going on elsewhere as well. The question is, can it be sustained? And I would say yes, provided that policymakers in the region are sufficiently agile. I mean, the commodities boom has big benefits for the region, but it also carries risks. And one of the results at the moment is currency appreciation. You know, Latin American currencies are becoming very strong because short-term money is coming in from abroad because because these currencies are seen as, or these countries are seen as commodity, and China plays in investor speak. And governments are taking measures to try and try and limit that. Why? Because if your currency becomes very, very strong, it becomes, you run the risk of what's called Dutch disease, which is a term that the Economist actually invented in the 1970s to describe what happened to the Dutch economy after the discovery of North Sea gas. So you get a strong currency as a result of commodity exports, and that makes life very hard if you're trying to produce anything except commodities. So it makes life very hard for manufacturers because imports, particularly from China, become very cheap. So that's a worry. And there are signs of overheating very early in the in this cycle. So the growth looks a little bit unstable. That argues for prudence. It argues for more focus on structural reform. Productivity remains, productivity growth outside agriculture in Latin America remains low. And so you need much more focus on improving infrastructure, on improving education and innovation and so on in the region. Latin America, and that focus on education is important because although Latin America is less unjust than it was, it is still in many ways more unjust than say, Europe. More needs to be done on tackling extreme poverty and on creating equality of opportunity and establishing the rule of law and tackling the violent crime, a lot of which is related to the drugs trade. And I said at the beginning that I don't think it's a question of what we can do for Latin America, but there's one exception to that. If we were to legalize drugs, it would make a hell of a lot of difference in Latin America by removing the mafias. Yeah? And so to sum up, I think there's been a lot of progress in the region, and it hasn't come through revolution. And I agree that some of the revolutions in Latin America were ersatz, right? It's much easier to talk about revolution in Latin America than to practice it, right? I would argue that actually the crowd has played a role in history in Latin America on occasions. The crowd is playing a role in history in Egypt at the moment. We don't actually know yet whether it's a revolution. It has not yet been consummated. You have to remember that there's a lot more people now in the capital city of Egypt than there was in Mexico City during the Mexican Revolution. So I think that's a bit misleading. But I also think actually the progress in Latin America has come from democracy and from reform and from the construction of better governance and better institutions and through the building of consensuses and not through polarization. And it's come from trial and error, from openness, and testing public policies against results and copying the ones that are successful and abandoning the ones that are not. And I think the so-called revolutions, which you will hear a lot about from Oliver Stone later in this film, I think are actually not the way in which you will cement that progress. So Latin America, I think, is part today, much of it, not everywhere, but much of it, is part of what The Economist we called in a cover just before Christmas the redistribution of hope in the world. I think it's a region which can inspire a lot of hope. Of course, a lot more needs to be done, but I think there has been significant progress. Thank you very much.